I just had a head massage up at the top there from a bloke called Roy. And I told him I was going to come down and give a talk, and he said, could I put a word in for him? That's what we do, us geezers. We look out for each other, you know what I mean? Roy knows how to make a pound. He's not paid me, but I'm dealing with it as a loss leader. Before I say anything more, always if I have the privilege of being encouraged to talk in this way, I need to tell you that if it wasn't for Sangharachita and my preceptor, who's called Maitreya Bandhu, I would have nothing of any significance or use to tell you. So I always start there. I owe those people more than I could ever repay them. But I didn't really intend to talk too much about Sangharachita. I wanted to tell you a bit more about my nan. So my nan, it occurred to me at some point whilst I got involved with Buddhism, the possibility that she might have been a bodhisattva or a Buddha even. And the reason I say that is that she quite naturally and ordinarily lived an entirely ethical life. So in Buddhism we have these training principles that we call the five precepts. The first is that the desire or the attempt to live without harm. The second is to practice generosity. The third, to live in a condition of stillness, simplicity and contentment, in particular in our intimate and sexual relationships. The third is to speak truthfully, and the fourth and the fifth is to keep a clear mind as far as possible involving the avoidance of intoxicants. And my grandmother did all those things quite normally and quite naturally. And that's what we're told about the Buddha. He didn't have to try to do any of that. It was just a natural expression of his realization of the way things truly are. So my nan isn't, as it turns out, a bodhisattva. And I'll explain why that is in a minute. But she was certainly, there was a famous story in my family where there was a knock on the front door, which was always a bit of a worry, a knock on the front door. You had to come round the back. Knock on the front door was usually bad news. It would be the school board man or somebody like that. Or the milkman wanting paying. Yeah. We used to have to like hide. My mum said, shh, it's the milkman. So, well, and off my nan went to the front door, came back with no skirt on. And somebody had knocked on the door selling Lucky Heather, congratulated her on her skirt, she took it off and gave it to her. That's what she was like. She was very, very sweet and kind, quite naturally. She, she loved me, my nan. Taught me what love is, actually. It's all right, I cry very easily. Always for sentimental rather than genuine reasons.
You're not recording us.
She met my grandfather when she was selling tickets at a freak show on Camberwell Green. This gives you an idea where we are in time now. In the Victorian era, they used to have under canvases these kind of freaks. Is that ringing any bells to you? Yeah, yeah, see where we are? She met my granddad there, and when she was 16, he was the only boy she ever kissed. For 63 years, they plagued the life out of each other. And so she didn't have to trouble about things like, sexual misconduct and so on and so on. But the reason I know that she wasn't a bodhisattva was that this was selective. Yeah? So she loved me I could say unconditionally, but that's not true. She loved me because I was her grandson. Yeah. If I hadn't been her grandson, I wouldn't have got a look in. Yeah. She was very loving and kind and generous to people around us. Because she was a Cockney, and that's what we were. And other people weren't Cockneys, and they were very suspicious for that reason. She wasn't very keen on foreigners, for instance. She used to say they're a funny lot, foreigners. You never know where you are with them. Yeah. And that was particularly true of Germans. So what happened was, sometime in the early part of the century, these people in Central Europe, apparently, decided that some area of land was going to be called Germany. And some bits of land that were inside that border, other people didn't think should be called Germany, and some pieces of the land that were just outside it, people who were inside it thought it should. And that led to a whole kerfuffle, which went on for quite a long time, culminating in a bomb landing on my grandmother's house. And in my family, we take that sort of thing very personally. So she wasn't very keen on Germans. Her name was Minnie. So she exists now, because I've just told you about her. Her name actually wasn't Minnie. Her name turned out to be something else. I think it might have been Eliza or something like that. And the date of birth that she thought she was turned out to be not her date of birth. We found that out later on when we tried to get her a passport. And that's what, really what I'm trying to say, to see, like, she was called something, but that's not necessarily what she was. And this piece of land was called Germany, although it wasn't really Germany. That's just what they called it. So what we find when we look at later Buddhist teaching is that things don't exist as of their own until they're named. Yeah? Once you call something a thing, it comes into existence and it solidifies. But that's not really what it is. There is no thing, really. All there is change and process. My name was from Peckham, which is where Del Boy's from. You know who Del Boy is? So I modelled my life on Del Boy, and that's how I ended up being a diamond geezer. So in the middle of all this, somehow or other, for reasons that I can't quite recall, I ended up in this Buddhist centre in Bethnal Green in East London. Very odd, that was, because it wasn't the sort of place I would go. Do you see, like, because I had this idea of who I was and I named myself this thing, I was a bit of a chap, a face around town, a good fella, diamond geezer. I didn't go to Buddhist centres. That would have been ridiculous. But somehow or other, I ended up in this place. And what happens when you go to Buddhist centres is sooner or later you sit down on a cushion and you close your eyes and you begin to see that things aren't quite what you thought they were. So this whole business of differentiation between, Cockneys and people who weren't Cockneys, South London and North London, Germany and Britain, me and you, right and wrong, men and women, is just simply how we divvy things up. When you sit and close your eyes, what you see is it's just all going on within the context of this thing that we call mind. And only by naming it do we give it some kind of a form. And then that gets us into all sorts of trouble, because then we get stuck with it. So somewhere in those early days, I came across the Diamond Sutra. And I came across it because Sangharachita, the founder of Triratna, in his autobiography, said that when he was 16, he read the Diamond Sutra and knew or realised that he was a Buddhist. So I thought, well, that's the one for me, then we'll have a look at that. That'll soon sort those things out. So I got hold of a copy of it, read it, couldn't make head and tail of it. Make a blind bit of sense. It's framed as a sort of an imaginary conversation between an imaginary Buddha and an imaginary Subhuti. And it goes something like, I think the Buddha asks, how many living beings are there? And Subhuti says, oh, there are many living beings. And they conclude that there are as many living beings as there are grains of sand in the river Ganges. And yet, Subhuti, no living beings exist. Living beings are simply what we call living beings. There are no living beings. When you spend a lot of time outdoors, as I have been lately, not because I'm a homeless wanderer, but because I've got nowhere else to go. I had, you're sort of amongst nature, and the metaphor of the leaf, which is something which is actually in the tradition of Buddhism, to talk about impermanence, but something I find very useful. So at the moment these leaves are green, aren't they, and they're a verdant colour. At some point or other, they're going to begin to get yellow, reddy yellow, and then they fall off the tree and they end up on the ground, and now they're very yellow, and soon they become mush, and so forth. They change colour, size, shape, and apparently, I'm told, molecular structure. There is nothing about that leaf, which is on the floor, which is the same as the leaf that was on the tree, except that we call it leaf. So, and of course we do need to do that, otherwise we'd be in an awful confused state. So, you know, the monks outside the temple who during their work period are sweeping the small yellowy crinkly things which are different in shape than they were, that wouldn't work, would it? You'd have to say, sweep the leaves. So we need this, you know, there are times when we need to kind of identify things, we need words and so forth, but we need to remember always that they're metaphors, that they're pointing us towards something. I've got a little grandson, and I was watching my daughter with my grandson, and he's pointing, and my daughter said to him, tree. Yeah? Quite obviously, it's quite a good thing, he needs to know what that's called, tree. But it just occurred to me in that instant that kind of fluttering, dappled light, noise of wind through the leaves, swaying, solid trunked experience has been whittled down to tree. Yeah? And there's your problem. As soon as we start naming things and calling things something, then we limit ourselves. And here's another example of that, Buddhism. If I say I'm a Buddhist, the problem I then have is that anything that an Islamist has to tell me, I'm much less likely to listen to or take any notice of, because it doesn't fit into the schema of what I think is the right way, you know what I mean, or the true path. And yet I need Buddhism, because without it, I don't know what I'm doing, I'm flailing around. So what it does is it offers me a structure, it gives me a series of practices. Based on my experience of those practices, I can begin to sort of think that I'm making sense of them. I'm finding myself becoming a bit kinder, a bit kind of happier even. I even occasionally touch a sense of liberation. That's because someone's been this way before, it provided all this for me. I can just go along and follow it, and we'll call it Buddhism. But it's not really Buddhism, is it? Buddha wasn't a Buddhist. So it's just always worth remembering. And of course, in the Dharma talks about the need to remember that when we come to something like Buddhism, we're talking about it as the raft which takes us to the further shore. The raft itself is no good to man or beast. It's completely pointless. You don't want to get to the further shore and then find yourself lugging it about, do you? Just in case you want to come back. So this thing that the Diamond Sutra points at and leads us towards about the difficulty in identifying and solidifying something by calling it something in particular, whether that's Diamond Geezer or whatever else, is not kind of ultimately going to help us. At some point, we've got to let go of that. At some point, we've got to let go of identity and step into the unknown. Yeah? Absolutely terrifying. Yeah. I spend a lot of my time completely frozen in fear. Because I don't know who I'm supposed to be now. I used to know, but now I don't. So that's just a little bit of something about movement to... I'm not sure if that's a V sign or there are 2 minutes. The last stanza of the Diamond Sutra is... Thus should we view this fleeting world. A flash of lightning on a summer sky. A star at dawn. A flickering lamp. A bubble in a stream. A phantom and a dream. Thank you for listening to me.